Hello, listeners. The ideas discussed on this show are presented solely for general information, education, and entertainment purposes, and should not be used as a substitute for the advice of a physician, psychotherapist, or other qualified professionals. Still Learning, the podcast, does not promote or condone the use of illegal substances. We champion safe and responsible use of psychedelic therapeutics under the care and supervision of clinical guidance.
Trigger warning. In this episode, we discuss some heavy topics that may be disturbing to some listeners, including sexual abuse, suicidal ideation, and some frank discussions about sex. If you have been affected by sexual assault, there is help out there. Contact the RAIN Network at rain.org or call them at 800-656-4673. If you're struggling with thoughts of suicide, please contact the Suicide Crisis Hotline by dialing 988.
This is Madigan, the co-producer. Hey, everyone.
Hi.
Indy and I were chatting, and there are so many wonderful things that we have learned, no pun intended, on this season of Still Learning. And we have had so many wonderful discussions of just like wrapping up after each interview, talking about all of the cool things. We talk about a lot of great things between the two of us as we've worked on creating this show. So we thought it would be fun to just chat. I'm going to ask you some questions. You can explain, and we're just going to kind of go over the season. I don't know. And we'll just kind of see where it goes. I'm very excited to kind of like do a recap of everything we've done over the last how many months? When was our first interview? Was that in like February, March?
Damn, when was that?
Okay, I'll cut this out, but I genuinely want to look. I have a picture somewhere and I want to see when it is.
Wait, oh, with Diane. Okay.
Yeah.
It was February.
That's pretty amazing. And okay. I don't remember when you reached out to me initially about wanting to do this, but it does seem like this was a pretty like expedited process. Like once we decided we wanted to do this show, it was like both of us kind of just dove right in right away, especially once we got our first interview done. We got Sochal, you got Jason, you know, we got all of these wonderful people that wanted to sign on. And we also got some wonderful people that are wanting to be a part of the next season, which is crazy.
I know. If I think about myself in your apartment recording Diane's episode, just back in February, and I was so freaking nervous. And like, I've been on the receiving end of, I don't know, maybe 100 plus podcasts in the past
more
couple
than that.
Of years. I don't know. I haven't really kept count, but I,
including my own show,
exactly, including the Angry Feminist podcast. So I feel like
that is me.
You inspired me to just do it. And I've been thinking about this idea for the past 2 years after I put out my book with the same name, Still Learning. Yeah. I thought, like, where do I go from here with this project? Like, I just invested a lot of my time and resources into recording and putting that book out there. But it was also, like we mentioned, during the pandemic. So it wasn't like I was doing a press tour, or I wasn't like going to Barnes and Noble and showing my little Audible station. Like, that just wasn't happening for me at
the
time.
It was a totally different vibe. And we quickly were like, okay, we got to hit record, because we were already talking about some of this stuff before we started recording the episode. And I was asking you, because in a recent interview, we were discussing the making of Seduced, your documentary series that you did, and you were talking about how you were writing Still Learning at the same time that you were creating Seduced, something that I did not know. I didn't realize that that was something that was happening at the same time. And just now, I was just thinking, well, wait, when did you film Seduced, because it came out in 2020. So you were telling me that you filmed it in 2019. And if you could just remind me and the listeners again, when you left Nexium, when you were able to escape.
Oh, I mean, the escape part seems so nuanced because I left Albany in February, end of February, 2018. And I moved to New York City, started looking for jobs and anything that I could get to ground me because my life was falling apart. But,
and you were living still at Allison's apartment at this time too, right?
So before she was evicted.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you were kind of like one foot in, one foot out. It seems like you were trying to build this normal life for yourself and, like, you know, work at a restaurant. You met your future husband, Patrick, you know, all of these things. But at the same time, you still had this hold on you by this group. So it definitely was a longer process for you to be able to get out of it.
It was.
But I'm just amazed that within such a short amount of time from escaping and filming that documentary series, it does shock me a little bit that you were able to go back so quickly in your process of healing and be able to tell that story.
Me too.
And I didn't realize how quick all of that happened in the timeline.
So fast.
Was that really overwhelming for you?
I think I was just used to being overwhelmed. And so, like, to me, that was just part of what I needed to do to move through it almost. It was like, I just didn't see a lot of options for myself at that time. And these options seemed like the best options that I could get. One, I could share my side of the story and my experience firsthand in an intimate environment, AKA writing a book. Like, what can get, like, what's more intimate than words, basically?
Right.
It's like a private diary. And
your book really is like a private diary when you read it. It is like listening to your innermost thoughts.
Yeah. And that's what it felt like. And so I think it was the start for me of getting reacquainted with my own mind and my own thoughts in private. And that was like the beautiful part about writing. The documentary was different because it involved more of a collaboration with other artists, directors, producers, cinematographer, like all the stuff that I had been familiar with from having a production background. But now the focus was on me and something that was super intimate and raw and also really fresh for me.
Yeah.
Like the only reason I think I was able to do what I did was because I worked with the FBI for 9 months and had to literally in a linear fashion say, this is what happened next. And they'll advise you to not take any notes, to not write anything down, because anything that you do write down can technically be subpoenaed. And so it's like hard to process what you're going through. For one, you can't talk to anybody else because you're supposed to be silent about your work with them. And I get that. There's many reasons for that. But then where do you go with yourself?
Like, where do you get support? Yeah.
Exactly.
Were you able to talk to your mom about that? Or was that still complicated because you were rebuilding that relationship as well?
I was definitely able to talk to my mom about that. And she and Patrick were like my main allies throughout that time, because I kind of shrunk my circle down intentionally. And also I was advised to, you know, trust less.
Yeah. Which I think you needed to do in order to recalibrate who you could trust, because the group took that away from you.
My Geiger counters were so off. Like, I just, like, even if somebody was coming to me and they were saying, like, here is a brand new car, I would have been like, fuck you. I don't
trust
you.
Too good to be true.
Yeah, exactly. Or if somebody was like, hey, like, let me help you out, I'd be like, okay. Like, I didn't have the gauge.
That's why it's kind of surprising to me that you responded to me in general. For, you know, the listeners of your show that don't know, I just slid into India's DMs and now 3 years later, we're pals.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting to me because I messaged you in 2020 and I was like, hey, you seem a lot like me. We should be friends if you want a friend. The fact that you were like, yeah, I'm going to message this weird Madigan chick back and see where this is going to go. I don't know, maybe fate was taking over there. But the fact that you trusted me enough, we were talking about this too, the first time you came into my house, I was like, what if I'm a murderer? And you didn't know it. And you're just showing up to a random apartment in Valley Village to record a podcast. You don't know.
Yeah, and that's true. But I think part of the learning curve is learning to trust again. And learning to trust is about earning that trust with another person. And that starts with yourself. And so I think me learning to trust my own instincts has helped me refine my process of trust. So like if something feels off, like now at least I can recognize that. Whereas before I just didn't have a sense of my instincts because they felt so wonky. And yeah. So like there's been plenty of people who have reached out to me on Instagram and I don't respond, but a majority is positive and it's just kind of like nice banter or people wanting to share their experiences similar to that were similar to mine. And, you know, you don't develop a relationship with every single person that you chat with, but like there's like discretion. And I think like I'm learning that too. And I think the internet is kind of like the Wild West. So you got to get smart. And I have had to learn the red flags of the internet too, because there's cons and there's sneaky shit and there's
there's legit internet cults out there. You know what I mean? Like it truly is the wild, wild west.
You got to get wise. So,
well, we got to get really, really wise. And yeah, I definitely experienced that as well when I interact with some listeners on my own show, where you can generally get a vibe pretty quickly off of people, whether or not it's someone that you want to continue that banter with, or whether or not that's just someone that maybe you will interact with on a more like mild basis or something like that, if they're, you know, supportive of you and things like that. I really want to go back and talk a little bit about the trajectory of our experience working on this show, going back to when we interviewed Diane. And can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like for you? Because that was the only episode that we did in person together. It was my first time spending a big chunk of time with you in person. And it was also a very vulnerable episode and state that you were in, which taught me a lot about you and about what this show was going to look like. But what was your experience recording that first episode?
I was excited and nervous, but I was also feeling like quite a bit of self-judgment that I was trying to override and like get through. And I thought, okay, this is your first time recording on your own for your own show. Give yourself a little bit of a break here. Like it's who just pops out perfect. Like that just doesn't exist. Like obviously there's going to be a learning curve here too. And so I think looking back, I was really just stressed and nervous. I remember even wanting to smoke a joint before I even recorded the episode, but I was like, this isn't going to help me out. I'll wait until
I need to clear mine. Yeah. We smoked a joint afterwards and you know, that was a great time. Yeah,
it was. Oh. We had mac and cheese, one of my favorite foods. So
yeah, I made it as positive as we could that day.
It was. And I think what was great for me was it gave me a little bit of perspective of what these past 5 years have been like for me and just like how fucking muted I felt when I first came out of the group and how it was just impossible for me to tell the truth. Like everything just felt so confused inside of me. And so going back and revisiting those first kind of fragile months when I was out and trying to find my footing and figure out what was real, I was like really vulnerable. I mean,
yeah,
I didn't realize how many things I had put myself through just to even get to that place. So I was actually like giving myself a little pat on the back towards the end of it, going like, holy shit, like I've really, really tried to pull the pieces of my life back together. One from like a state of kind of like, I gotta survive, but also from like a personal dignity standpoint of like, wow, this was really fucked up. And I didn't even realize that it was that fucked up when I was there. And now I can look back and go, okay, what happened? And I feel a certain confidence inside of me that I didn't have before, which is like, I just know that I would never let something happen to me like this again. And
yeah, because you were given the tools to understand what you had been through already.
And I was also like fixated on figuring it out because I was like, how did this just happen to me? And I was unaware. And so being able to, and that's where Seduced really kicked in for me, because that collaboration with the filmmakers and our subject, like the other subjects in the doc, really started to put the pieces together for me of like, wow, this was a systematic process of indoctrination and grooming. And that's what I wanted to teach through my story, which was, this is a process. This process actually happens just about everywhere that there's power, you know, positions of power. So if you know what to look for, you can actually avoid it, and you can actually avoid negative influence. And like, that's kind of what I wanted the message to be. And I think that it did a pretty good job at that.
It did a great job. I actually wanted to say, I've looked at reviews of both your book, Still Learning, and of Seduced. And, you know, I do my job as a co-producer. I'm like, what are you saying? What do we need to know? And the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah,
but
no kidding.
Something that I read in a lot of the just personal reviews of Seduced was people applauding how educational it was. There was a lot of people that had seen The Vow on HBO and felt like they weren't given the answers to how this happened to everybody. It was more of a spectacle because it was about bringing down the group and all this stuff. And the people that watched Seduced were talking about how they wished they saw that first, because it explained how everybody in The Vow got to where they were. It was really about an understanding of psychological manipulation, and it actually educated them on the topic rather than just experiencing what the people leaving the group were doing.
Which was traumatic for them. But if you don't know the psychology of what was going on for them and what it took them to even make that leap from being inside the group to then being defectors, is fucking triumph. Like,
and how is a viewer going to understand that? And I think that's the thing that was missing that Seduced did grab onto, was that it had more of an explanation to it. It humanized the people that were in this group instead of making it seem like these are some cuckoo bananas people that followed this really ugly dude that loves volleyball. Like, you know, there's...
Yeah. You don't want people to leave with that impression. You want them to humanize them and go, wow, like I can identify with those characters and that desire to want something to be good so badly. Yes. I feel like that's like a lot of those people who left initially all had broken hearts because
of course, you thought believe, it was so good.
Yeah. You believe that it is good and you internalize that, and then to realize that you're wrong and be willing to be wrong publicly says a lot about a lot of these people's character, in my opinion, and different levels of bravery and also different levels of responsibility and participation. Like those who really were involved in the upper echelons, if you will, really took it upon themselves to expose it, and like my mom had a whole other mission involved because it had to do with me, her child. And so I think like that's something that I've also had to really repair. And I think like that's why this story has been so personal for me, is it affected me, my family, my name, and my public perception. And it's like the other day I was talking to Patrick and I was like, you know, in a weird way, like for what it's worth, I've kind of like always lived a big life. Like I was born into it. Like I was born the daughter of an actress who...
You were never unknown.
Yeah. Like there's like baby pictures of me when I was first born.
Google India Oxenberg and you'll see adorable toddler photos of you in frilly dresses. Like it is,
it's weird.
It does have to be a very strange thing, but I have to say that I feel like in doing Seduced, in working with the FBI, in writing your book, in doing the show, you are creating a stronger identity for yourself that is separate from your mother, that's separate from the cult, that's separate from all of those things. And I think that that's why people and the general public who knew the story of NXIVM related to you particularly so much. And I think that's why I related to you as well, because it wasn't some cuckoo story about a girl in a cult. It was about a family. It was about a girl growing up. It's about falling in love and making mistakes. It's about building your career choices. You know, there's all of these different things that really is encapsulated in your story that is relatable to lots of different people. Instead of hearing this cult story that seems so unrealistic to some people, you were able to make it very understanding and very concise. And I felt like in our interview with Diane, it was really a continuation of that. And one of the things that I noticed is the relationship that you two had. And I almost think of it as like when you were first leaving the cult, it was almost like Diane had to mother you a little bit or be your teacher. And she kind of had to like coddle, take care of you, talk to you, teach you, educate you. But then by the time you got to this interview, it was like you two were speaking as equals. You two could both talk about this shared experience that you had together. And that was just something that I noticed, but I'm wondering if that's something that you've felt or recognized, particularly with that interview that we did.
I think for me, I mean, the show is called Still Learning for a reason. And I think that's because I just have a lot of questions and I love to learn about other people and I love to learn about myself. So yeah. I think that interview did show me that I have grown and that I've learned a lot in these past couple of years and that I take this very seriously and that there's something about having people to look up to who are just like a couple steps ahead of you. And Diane is many steps ahead of me in her recovery process and just, you know, being out of a cult for much longer than me, but we're also still peers in an interesting way. And so like, I kind of love that where it sort of doesn't matter what your age is, like you could be younger or older and there's always something to learn from someone. And whether they're like 3 years old or 68, plus, that's kind of like the position that I wanted to take in this series, and that everyone has their unique wisdom and they bring it to the table and it's there to help us. So yeah. I think like that's what Diane provided for me, especially in the early days. A non-judgmental ear, I think, can go a long way.
Totally. And talking about other quote unquote peers that have come on the show this season, I immediately thought about Hoyt Richards. And, you know, Hoyt's been Social. Out of, and Social, of course. But, you know, Social, I think, when did she escape?
Oh, 7 years ago.
Okay, so but you two, to me, seem like, you know, you are relatively around the same amount of years out. Yeah. And it seems like, you know, because, and we're going to get to Social. I definitely want to talk more about her because you had your experience at the retreat together. But it was also interesting to see your interview with Hoyt, because he's been out of Eternal Values for 20 years. And that was also really interesting to me because it wasn't as long ago as the Moonies, like Diane, where I think a lot of people have different perceptions of what, you know, the cults of the 70s were like. And we talked to someone of, you know, a cult from the 90s, like 80s and 90s, and someone who's been out maybe a little bit longer than you have. And then we had the interview with Social. And that one was so special for me to be a part of because you two seem to be doing a lot of healing together.
You know, I think when it comes to Social, she is just such a good example for me of a resilient human being. And she just reminded me so much of a, like what I said, resilience. Like the first time we met was also in the pandemic and we met in person. And we had coffee and we spoke for 4 hours and everything that she said and everything that I said, it was like a match. It was like we had just almost parallel experiences with totally different players, if you will. But we would be like, oh, that was my version of so-and-so, or that was my version of so-and-so. And it was like kind of wild. But what it showed me was how much more similar these types of experience are when it comes to the effects that it has on an individual, and that it made me feel less alone, even in my own, you know, mental health struggles that I've had. We had camaraderie there. We could understand each other. We understood each other's pain, and there's like bonding that comes from that. And also it gave me hope that I could be as strong as her. And she just is someone who just doesn't want to give up and wants to
she's
see change.
Feisty.
Yeah.
And she's got like, that. She's got that personality. Yeah. She's very much like, you know, I'm sure she's just as scared as you are all the time of being vulnerable and putting yourself out there. But she's one of those people that I feel like is able to like harness that fear in a way and turn it into getting like, and this is something I deeply understand, turning it into like productive anger. You know what I mean? Like her, if you follow her on Instagram, she's just got this like grit and feistiness to her where she's not willing to lower her voice or not be heard. She's very, very, very outspoken. And I want to make a quick note of something that you said, because you were mentioning how when you and Sochal first met, you were noticing how similar your experiences were and your, you know, leaders, I guess, were. And that's actually a joke made in that episode that we were like, should we cut the penis chokes? And I'm like, please don't. They're too good. But, you know, it's interesting because something else you've said during.
I didn't want to be insensitive, but I also understand that, like, you know, both of us have been through a lot, and so have a lot of other people. And sometimes you just need to laugh a little.
You have to. And that's why I was like, no, please keep it in, because it's too real. But something else that you had said to me is like, well, I don't feel so special anymore, because like Sochal had those people, Hoyt had those people, you know, I thought I was the only, you know,
socialite cult.
What's the deal? I thought I was the only sex cult. What's
not
going
even
on?
Close.
And you're not even close. And that's the thing. But the world wants to make you think that you're alone in that and you're not. And I think that there's something, you know, you would phrase it, I'm less special. I would not phrase it that way. I think you're incredibly special, and every experience is unique. You know, you can't truly compare any experience, but I can't imagine the relief to feel, to find somebody, to find multiple people that truly could see through all of the other bullshit and see you for who you are through your experiences. Okay.
That the actual retreat that we had, it was hosted by the nonprofit that I run with my mom. So we have the Katherine Oxenberg Foundation, which has Helix underneath it. And then we've got a website, Helix 180. And this had to do with Helix Immersion, which is our pilot program. And we're trying to create a alternative to rehab, I guess you could say.
Yeah, like a treatment center.
A treatment center. And we use psychedelic-assisted therapy for that, specifically with ketamine, which is called CAP. I think what I realized with Sochal even more so at that retreat was that everyone's idea of success and recovery is so unique to them that you can't really put a standard of success. And I actually loved when, and we'll get there too, when Juan Cortez, one of the other people that we interviewed this season, said that success is getting somebody in the door. And I kind of felt like that for myself. Like success for me was deciding to go and seek deeper treatment and to grow my support system, because it's hard to do this all on your own. And it's actually amazing to have camaraderie and to be able to do that with people who really understand your experience very deeply. Saves you a lot of time and energy and having to explain yourself.
Yeah.
And so it took a lot of pressure off of, like, you know, maybe a conventional therapy situation where they may or may not know anything about high control groups. You're sort of like having to teach the person what that was like for you. And that can be really stressful on the survivor.
It shouldn't be the survivor's responsibility to be teaching their therapist.
It shouldn't, but it's
definitely an issue.
But it happens. So like,
it does.
I mean, look at me. I didn't seek therapy for a long time because I felt it was too stressful. It wasn't until like after I put out the documentary that I kind of felt like, okay, maybe whoever is my therapist could just watch this and then I could go to the session and we could start right now rather than me having to spend several months going backwards into my life all the time. Like PTSD does that enough.
Yeah. I mean, I am not a cult survivor, but I mean, I've been in therapy for 20 years of my life in and out. Yes. And I've gotten the note from so many therapists. My first session, when I sit down and I tell them my life story, they're always just like, did you rehearse that? And I'm like, no, I've just been telling new therapists since I was 10. Yeah. I know the trauma, like the back of my own hand. Let me read you my life story really quick. And it's like, oh, damn. But I also think that with your
retreat.
Can
I add something to that for the retreat? Yeah. So why I think that's so important is that like my standard of success for myself is having a meaningful life that matters to me and having a regulated nervous system and taking care of my relationships. And honestly, like that's fucking success. So
it's also success that you were able to find something that worked for you and recognize the fact that this could be beneficial to other people. And you weren't like, I'm just going to keep this to myself and I'm going to do my healing. You're like, no, this is fucking revolutionary. And I need to get everyone in my life that I love and care about who's been through the same thing as me to heal the same way that I have. And I think that that's a huge success.
Well, thank you. And I look at it also a little differently because I've been able to add to my toolkit significantly in the past couple of years. And yes, a lot of these things have worked for me personally, but everybody is so different and that you can't say like, this is the roadmap to healing. It's just one map. Like
it's an option.
There's so many maps to healing and like, it's up to you to find.
But people need to know their options. Like, how are you going to even know that there's an alternative to regular psychiatry and therapy and taking pills? I mean, this is something that you and I have discussed a lot because I've been on medication for 20 years and it's like, doesn't feel like it's helping, but if I don't take it, I go even crazier. So it's
balancing something.
Yeah. And it's trying to find your own roadmap of healing is so infuriating, but at least knowing all of your options, you can then say, ooh, that sounds like something I'm interested in. And I want to try that. And it has helped me try new forms of therapy. And sometimes I try it out and I'm like, oh, that's not for me. I'm going to back out. And it sounds like that's something that you really had to do in discovering your own methods of healing as well.
Definitely. I had to refer to myself. And that's been my learning is just going back and going, okay, does this work for me? India, does this make your life better? Does this make things easier for you? And it's like kind of this back and forth. And I learned a lot from the other women who participated in this pilot program because they were all doing different things to help themselves. And they were all at different stages of recovery too. And so it just shows you how, once again, resilient people are, because I had a perception that healing would be easier and that healing sexual trauma would be easier. And it just absolutely has not been. And I think that's something that a lot of people carry a lot of shame about, and that even talking about it starts to make people anxious or uncomfortable. And it makes sense because it's a lot of our deepest, darkest shames and our vulnerabilities. And it makes you feel weak and it makes you feel powerless and all of these feelings that you don't want to feel. So the natural tendency to stuff it down and not talk about things and not process things makes sense to me because these things are painful and emotional pain is real.
And that's also something we've been taught our entire lives for centuries, for generations. One, that sex should not be discussed. But also, I think that there's a real misconception here because, you know, when we think of sexual trauma, when we think of rape, when we think of sexual assault, in my opinion, we're still tying sex too much into the equation. Because non-consensual sex is not sex. That's rape. That's assault. That's abuse. Mm-hmm. They should not correlate together. So the fact that society views sexual assault and rape still as sex And sex is private. We don't talk about it. We don't share our sex lives with people. That's between a man and a woman. It's between a partner and a partner, you know, whatever. So why would we feel comfortable enough to share those experiences, to not feel like we have to protect our abusers, to not feel like we have to protect our own reputations and identities?
Well, because
by coming forward with quote unquote sexual trauma.
I mean, who wants to be known as a victim of someone for the rest of their lives? So I think why a majority of women don't say anything ever, is because even if you have experienced sexual violence in your life, going forward and having to either one, explain yourself, or have people look at you as in a certain way is so uncomfortable. Yeah. It's like, I'd rather not. Like, yeah. I didn't have that choice because I didn't have my anonymity, obviously, right, regarding Nexium. But there's a part of me that was like, I wish that nobody knew any of this about me.
Yeah. And you really didn't have much of a choice, unfortunately, because a lot of those decisions were made for you and you were still in the cult. And I'm sure that's something you've had to work through, you know, and understand that, you know, people knew your story before you were even done with the group, which is frustrating. But yeah, it also,
or they, they knew a part of it.
Right. Or, and it makes you feel like people have seen you naked in a way.
I used to say that everyone was in my underwear drawer and I was can you just get out?
Well, and also, you know, I've looked at, you know, comments and even things like that on your Instagram where people will be really sexually gross with you. And I'm like, what is your fucking problem? Like, it's just, why don't people understand to be a normal fucking human being? I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But I'm glad we started talking about this because I know that you and I had talked about how we wanted to discuss a little bit of healing from sexual trauma and things like that. And it probably would make another, we could probably talk another hour or two.
I know. And I have been learning and am still learning, and really just inviting in a more open conversation that I like to say, like, no shame in the pain, because like, who hasn't had a difficult experience in their lives or has lived a difficult life? Like, that's why I don't like to compare trauma, because the spectrum of suffering is so great in the world. And so,
everybody reacts to trauma differently as well, you know?
Yeah. Really, what I've seen that's the hardest, and this is specific to anyone who's had like intense psychological manipulation, is that the reconstructing of yourself after you get out of the toxic environment is so difficult in itself. But that's the road to freedom. And I feel like that's the road that is often neglected, because the pain of revisiting those traumas is too much.
It's and too I think hard.
That's why I've needed help and assistance. And I have found a lot of comfort in using psychedelics for, you know, for some of these issues, because it helps me bypass some of the barriers and the walls that I've put up to my own self when it comes to my sexuality, when it comes to personal expression, when it comes to being artistic. All of these, like, I could be the lone judger on a hill, literally judging myself all day long for different shit that I want to do, and do nothing and be completely paralyzed and then forever feel like I'm a victim of my trauma. And that's just something that I just didn't want. I have felt victimized a lot in my life. And I was like, okay, I'm 32 years old now. Like, when is this going to end? Like, when am I going to be the one that goes, you know what? My life is in my own hands now. I'm physically free. I'm mentally freer than I've ever been. I've got the capacity to do anything that I want. I'm so lucky. I have support. I have all these things. And still, I get plagued with anxiety and depression and PTSD symptoms. But at least because of the options that I have now, I see options for myself rather than just hitting those walls and feeling hopeless and, you know, going down the downward spiral of self-destruction and so on and so forth.
Because it is like a revolving door a lot of times too, when we're not able to heal from our trauma, a lot of times we will end up putting ourselves into very similar situations over and over and over again until we learn that lesson.
It's like a hologram.
To do it or not, it is. So the fact that it's important to be able to step back and acknowledge the fact that you do have to go through that healing process in order to get back into your life fully as well. And it makes me so happy to know and to think about where you are in your life, the support that you have, the choices that you've made for yourself, especially as somebody who started as an outsider in your story and has slowly become more and more ingratiated into your life. It really is something to kind of marvel at a little bit, the way that you've been able to take all of these steps for yourself in order to heal and really, really make sure that you are surrounding yourself with people that are so, so genuine. I do want to mention Jason really quick.
Yeah.
Because that's like one of my favorite episodes, weirdly. It's like,
I loved that episode.
I loved it. Like, it was the only one I didn't listen in on. You guys just did that.
We did it in New York. Because you know what's amazing about that episode for me, at least, was that it showed me that the exact same tool can be used for good or for evil. And like the same way that words can be used in different ways and you can internalize them differently. Like me saying, why is this happening to me? Versus why is this happening to me? Is like a totally different mental viewpoint. Like one is I'm going to blame the world for everything that's happened to me. The other is I'm going to kind of take a moment and pause here and go, why did this happen to me? Because I've seen this happen to myself a couple times and I'm wondering what participation I have versus like, I'm just a victim of the world. And like, that's been where I've had to tweak my mental perception.
Yeah.
And like Jason, even just talking about honoring the con.
He's saying, credit the con.
Yeah, credit the con.
We've said that so much since you recorded that episode, because like that really struck a nerve with me as well. Credit the con. It was so bizarre to listen to.
Less victim shaming.
Yeah. But it was funny because like, you know, we're listening to a magician who literally like manipulates people for fun for a living, talking to a cult survivor who was manipulated in like a super not fun way.
No. If you want to abnegate responsibility for your entire life and have somebody else take the lead and basically, you know, be on autopilot or more or less sit in the passenger seat, join a cult.
Cults are a great choice for you.
Yeah, great choice for you. You've got the built-in community. You've got totalitarian leadership.
You have to give all of your money to the leader, though. Sorry, you're going to be broke. You're probably not going to have any friends outside of that group.
Correct.
There's a lot of negatives, but like if you don't want to have any like personal autonomy or make any decisions for yourself, which honestly sounds like a really good idea to me most of the time, join a cult.
I get it. I get it. I've been there, done that. And I was 19 and I just thought that I was experiencing something positive for myself.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I have the Scientology building of the Valley, literally a mile down the road from me. I pass it every time I go to In-N-Out. I passed it going to McDonald's this morning. And it's like, it's so normalized and prevalent. And the parking lot is always full. And I'm like, this is nuts, especially with the amount of knowledge we have on Scientology and stuff. But it's like, it's so common. Everywhere.
Who doesn't want
maybe
community?
It's kind of in LA too.
Well, also yes, but no, but yes and no, because like we've said, there are cultic groups everywhere. You can be in a family that's like a cult. So it's just more about the dynamics that are the issue and the like the inversion of power and having somebody be more powerful than you or know what's best for you. I think that's the thing that I was confused about, especially when I joined, was thinking that somebody else knew my dreams and the path to my dreams more than I did, rather than just trusting that each thing that you choose to do will lead you to the next thing, which is like one way to look at life.
Yeah. And I think that that's really common in abusive romantic partnerships as well, is latching on to another person because you feel like they are validating you in some way. And especially if they're talking you up and believing in you, but then, you know, also, of course, tearing you down and things like that. But it does become this very separate sort of identity from you, and you will grab onto that other identity because you're feeling so unsure of your own. And I think that that's something that everybody has experienced, whether it be in a romantic partnership, in a friendship, between parents and kids, mm-hmm. in group settings, in regular churches. Like, it is something that I think all of us, especially when we're 17, 18, 19, and we're leaving home for the first time and trying to discover who we are, it does seem easier to almost just give yourself over to somebody who's maybe a little bit older, somebody who maybe has more life experience, maybe someone who's saying they are the smartest man in the entire world, and all of these other people are believing them. Why wouldn't you be like, well, then maybe I should at least see what this person has to offer for me? And you're also given so much love that you truly do believe that that person is thinking in your best interest as well.
Yeah, that was the mistake. Yeah. In believing that and having that ideal, you know, idealism, because there's a lot of truth to the saying, the company that you keep, mm-hmm. because it really does affect you, even if you're a quote unquote innocent bystander or a active participant or anywhere on that scale.
Yeah, exactly.
You're participating.
Yeah.
Whether you're conscious or not. And I think like the grooming and the indoctrination piece is so hard for people to decipher. Whether like, okay, is this me or is this the programming? And I see that a lot with other survivors. And I think the thing that I always go back to is if it has a lot of fear involved, it's generally not authentic to me.
Yep. I think it can be very, very hard. And I think shame is a big hindrance to healing in a lot of ways, because it's really hard for us to admit to ourselves when we were part of something that was negative, or if we did hurt other people. And I think especially for a lot of people that were leaving NXIVM, there was a lot of misunderstanding about different levels of involvement with different people and a misunderstanding of the grooming process. And people were so quick to label different members as good people or bad people. And that's not something that you can do when you are talking about psychological manipulation. It's so much more nuanced. Even talking about, you know, the frontline people in NXIVM, it is very hard, at least for me personally, to label people as good or bad, because you don't know what their grooming process was like, what their process of abuse was like. I do think there are people that are more to blame than others, obviously, who have done more illegal things and harmful things that they need to be punished for. Right. But I think when we're looking at the philosophy of what a good person and a bad person is, you do have to have an understanding of the gray area and the psychology of what these people have been through. And I think that that's something that we've really explored a lot this season, mm-hmm. and something that you've been very vulnerable about is that you were not a perfect person when you were in the cult, and you did a lot of things that India now wouldn't do, or even the India before the cult wouldn't have done.
Correct.
And being able to speak on your shame, to take accountability, to have responsibility, and to continue to not only want to help yourself, but help others, I think speaks to a person's character more than anything else, more than any other action or something that they could have done.
I think I believe in forgiveness. And I believe like that everyone is recoverable. And I think that's like the position that I like to take on my own healing, because it's given me some more self-compassion that I really needed, which was that, hey, you can change. Like, you can change who you are for better or for worse. And I've experienced a little bit of both at this point. And I think I know myself better now, and I didn't really know myself so strongly. And I think that's why I was easily swayed in one direction or another, because I meet some people in my life who are very clear on their morals and values. And I think those people are less likely to be conned.
Yeah.
Because they have a certain like knowing and solidity. Like I was even talking to Patrick and he was like, yeah, it's taken me a long time to really know what I want and to be clear on what I want. But I learned that in my 20s. And now that I'm in my 30s, I feel like I can say I know that I want this.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that took me so long to feel comfortable just saying like, I know I want this. I know I have this need, and to be able to even just vocalize that. And
yeah.
And like, I mean, back to Jason, because I do want to talk about that episode too. I think that one was really quite cool. And just to be able to see how it also shows that like a tool in the hand of a murderer versus the tool in the hand of a doctor.
A performer.
Yeah, it is a very, yeah. very different thing. And it's funny because they used to mention that a lot in Nexium, that they would say like, tool.
And you don't want the tools in the wrong hands.
Yeah,
you
know, and it's
that
like
kind of thing. Yeah, hiding. Well, you were the wrong hands.
Yeah, exactly. And how easily it is to be influenced by charisma and by really good marketing. And
yeah, and how we kind of want to be manipulated in a way is a weird thing that I got out of that episode, because like I remember my like senior year party in high school. It was like an overnight thing. We're locked in and they had this hypnotist, and I wanted to be hypnotized so bad. I was like, I want to be one of those people on stage doing really stupid shit and not remember any of it. And I wasn't hypnotized. Maybe I wanted it too badly. I don't know. But it did kind of like bring up that memory for me where it's like, in a way, we do want to experience that like helplessness in a way sometimes in our lives in different degrees. And when we're at a magic show or a hypnotist show, it's more of like a safe way of doing that.
Yeah.
But I think kind of in the same way where it's nice to have other people make your decisions for
right.
you.
Right. Surrendering to like the responsibility and saying like, yeah. now you're in charge, mm-hmm. versus me being in charge of what happens to me or having control. And I think that's also why people like to be in altered states too,
yeah.
because like you get an experience of yourself, not as your normal self that does everything, but another version of yourself that might be less restricted, maybe more yeah. open, more sexually engaged, like whatever it is.
Totally.
That, because yeah. you have this version, we have a version of ourselves that we like live by. And we think that this is it, like this is our character, that maybe we're going to be like this forever. And I just don't see people that way. I see us as so much more fluid. And also, I don't really think that everything is black and white in that way either. I think people are so colorful and there are so many versions of you that you get to discover as you age. And like, I'm just at the beginning of this new version of myself that I'm really starting to like a lot more than the version yeah. of myself before. And that saying of you can't teach an old dog new tricks, like I don't believe that.
Totally can't, because you're not going to be the same person in 10 years that you are right now either. And I don't want to be the same person in 10 years that I am right now. That's part of life. We should never feel like we're done learning and growing. And I think that that's a natural human experience, and something that we should encourage in each other is to not expect ourselves to be stagnant. We should always be growing.
No, and to also, for me at least, learning to enjoy and just live and
revel in like, the process.
Yeah, like that's been hard, but also something that I've really do want to learn to be better at is just like enjoying the things that I've earned, enjoying the people and the relationships that I have now, and not always being so focused on work and executing things, but actually like the quality of my life. I feel like I value yeah. that a lot more. And I think this season really showed me how much I've been able to improve the quality of my life by engaging with people who really inspire me.
And people who really see you too.
Yeah.
in a lot of different ways. And that was another thing with Jason's episode that I really loved, was because he was talking about the fact that he met you as his buddy's girlfriend or fiance, or, you know, it was really, really refreshing to hear so many different relationships of different relationships that you've had with different people that have come on this show. And I think that it's seeing multiple layers to what every person truly has within them and how we're viewed in the world and everything like that. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up from this season that you wanted to talk about?
I think if anything, I'd say that this show is evolving as I grow, and that I just feel really enthusiastic about where it's headed. I don't have a preconceived, you know, idea of where it's going to go.
Well, I mean, that's a setup for failure.
Yeah, no kidding.
You just got to go with it.
You just got to go with it. And I feel like that's what this season one has shown me, is that when you commit to something that you really care about, just keep going and let it evolve with you. That's what I feel like I'm learning from this. And instead of trying to control it or trying to have some kind of preconceived outcome of how each episode should go, like, I've had to let go of a lot of control and just say, like, hey, I'm ready to just have a good conversation. Like, let's see where this goes.
And it was also possibly, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first times that you were able to kind of sit in the interviewer seat a little bit, and it wasn't always so focused on you, even though most of our discussions related to your story and related to your history, it wasn't so much focused on you drudging up your trauma or other people bringing their trauma up. It was about relationships and harmony and all of these other things. And I think that that must have been a really wonderful and empowering experience for you, especially probably feeling like you've been on the receiving end of a lot of those questions for so many years.
It was certainly a little bit of pressure off of me, but also pressure placed in a different area, because
you don't want to be the bad interviewer.
No, of course not. I want them to leave the conversation feeling good. And that was really important to me, for this to not be a trauma focused series, but a trauma forward series. So really, like, what do you do post trauma? How do you grow? How do you evolve yourself? And what tools have you learned to enhance your life? And how are you giving back? Because I feel like so much of my healing has come from giving back and getting out of my own head and seeing a bigger world for myself.
Yeah.
Whereas I saw a very small world before. It's a small world after all, is like way too true.
Yeah. And I think that, not to, you know, toot our own horns here or anything, but I hope that's what makes us different than a lot of other podcasts that cover cults. Because I think that a lot of the stories and a lot of the ways that we've told the stories of cults has kind of been overdone, and we've heard it all. And so, like, what is that next step in our fascination with cults, with high control groups, with manipulation and fraudsters and scammers? And I think that next step is this show and talking about what happens afterwards, because I feel like, you know, as someone who, I hate calling myself a true crime fan. I don't think I'm a fan. I'm someone who
trauma likes, porn junkie.
It is, but it makes, for some reason, like, it's educational to me. It helps me feel like I can maybe prepare myself for bad situations. It's a whole other, I could explain to you right now why women are so obsessed with true crime, but it would take me like an hour, and I'm not going to do that.
To be continued.
But, you know, I think that there's a reason that we are also drawn to those stories and those narratives, but how can we continue to tell that same story over and over and over again without feeling like we're being left out of the victim's experience? So I guess that's kind of my hope for what everybody else got out of season one, just as I did, being kind of a fly on the wall, experiencing all of the interviews and everything.
Well, I hope something similar too, is that people leave each episode and they identify and find more of themselves. Mm. And that you sort of walk away with, wow, human beings are so much more similar than I thought, rather than like, we're so freaking different, because that's just not how I see the world. I feel like my healing has shown me how much more similar I am to other people. And that's kind of made me feel like
we're not alone.
A lot more hope for humanity too.
Totally.
Well, to close up, we wanted to let you all know that we'll be taking a little break from Still Learning the podcast. We really enjoyed doing season one, and we have so many great ideas for the show's future. In the meantime, we wanted to put together a little advice segment for the show. So if you have any questions about high control groups, healing, or supporting a loved one, feel free to reach out to our email at stilllearningthepodcast@gmail.com. All questions and messages will remain anonymous for the safety and respect of the sender. While you're waiting, be sure to check out our amazing Still Learning merch. It's all on the Still Learning website. So by clicking the link in the show notes or by clicking the link on our Instagram bio, you'll get directed to the merch. We've got original poetry written by me and updates for speaking events and more interviews. Until next time, remember, your freedoms will provoke people. So get used to it. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Still Learning. To support the show, we would greatly appreciate your review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and share the show with friends. To reach out and stay connected, follow us on Instagram at Still Learning the Podcast. Still Learning is produced and created by me, India Oxenberg, and Madigan, my co-producer and editor. The music in this show was created and produced by Max Ram.